We have almost made a conscious choice to keep this marvelous church a secret in Wichita, but when I look out this morning and see that there are people who can hardly find a place to sit, I think the secret must be out. For those of you who are visiting for the first time, you are warmly welcome. Before we look at our biblical text this morning, I've invited Mark Twain to set it up for us. Mark remembers that at age 15, he knew a young black slave in Hannibal, Missouri, who used to preach sermons from the top of his master's woodpile with Mark as his sole audience. He imitated the pulpit style of the several clergymen of the village, Mark writes, and did it well and with fine passion and energy. To me, he was a wonder. I believed he was the greatest orator in the United States and would someday be heard from. But it did not happen. In the distribution of rewards, he was overlooked. It is the way in this world. He interrupted his preaching now and then to saw a stick of wood. But the sawing was a pretense. He did it with his mouth, exactly imitating the sound the bucksaw makes in shrieking its way through the wood. But it served its purpose. It kept his master from coming out to see how the work was getting along. Forbidden by my mother to partake of his impudent and delightful society, I listened to the sermons from the open window of a lumber room at the back of the house. One of his texts was this: "You tell me where a man gets his corn pone, and I'll tell you what his pinions is." I can never forget it, Twain goes on. The black philosopher's idea was that a man is not independent and cannot afford views which might interfere with his bread and butter. If he would prosper, he must train with the majority. In matters of large moment, like politics and religion, he must think and feel with the bulk of his neighbors or suffer damage in his social standing and in his business prosperities. He must restrict himself to cornpone opinions, at least on the surface. He must get his opinions from other people. He must reason out none for himself. He must have no first-hand views. Cornpone opinions, based on self-interest, held tenaciously and sometimes loudly to keep the cornpone coming. We've been paying attention recently to some of the great themes in the book of Romans, and we come this morning to one of the greatest of all. Do not conform any longer to the patterns of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. What Twain calls cornpone opinions, this verse calls conformity. There is no better trivial example of how it works than the fashion industry. Somewhere in the basement, I have a collection of ties and sport coats that look as new as the day I bought them, all waiting patiently in the closet for the sultans of style to resurrect them. I used to think I was immune to fashion, and I still run well behind the times, but I have learned the power it has over me. When I needed a pair of brown slacks the other night, I pulled out a like-new pair, had a faint little twitch of doubt about them, and decided it might be wise to check with the resident critic. It's not her style to take a look and then dissolve in gales of uncontrollable laughter. She simply smiles gently and says, "Hello, Elvis." So I changed, and the power of conformity in dress won another victory. We all know how this works, and it was at work 100 years ago in Mark Twain's world. A certain kind of skirt, he writes, is suddenly popular. No fashionable woman dares ignore it. And then by and by it runs its course and disappears. Designers may kill it off, or it may be that one woman gives it up. Her neighbor notices and follows her lead. That influences the next woman, and so on and on until the skirt has vanished. No one knows how or why or cares. It will come again by and by, and in due course will disappear again. We are creatures of outside influence. For the most part, we do not think. We only imitate. An impulse born of our natural yearning for the approval and praise of our peers. And this is how Mark finishes that essay. The name of this great power is public opinion. It is held in reverence. It settles everything. Some think it is the voice of God. Well, fashions in dress are a source of pleasure for those who can keep up, a source of embarrassment for those who cannot, and are otherwise not of any great importance. They're not at all what Paul had in mind when he begged the church in Rome not to conform to this world. It sounds almost quaint now, but he believed in certain timeless values not meant to be at the mercy of public opinion. Courtesy, kindness, patience, self-control, responsibility, genuine concern for the welfare of others. I like the Phillips translation of what Paul said. Don't let the world around you squeeze you into its own mold, but let God remold your minds from within so that you may prove in practice that the plan of God for you is good, meets all his demands, and moves toward the goal of true maturity. The squeeze play from which fashion makes enormous profit is trifling compared to the pressures brought by the world against the character traits Paul says express the mind of Christ. Pick out just a single one of them, like courtesy, and think about how rare a commodity that has become in public life. So rare that when I find it, the unexpected, pleasant smile, the bonus of a cheerful hello, some small service beyond the call of duty, I'm so impressed I want to set up an immediate trust fund in that person's name. Talk with any teacher you know about the influence of Beavis and Butthead on courtesy in the classroom, and you will appreciate the power of television to set patterns of behavior. I've known a few kids who were basically polite, but who admitted to me that, yes, they were often rude in the classroom because it was considered the fashionable thing and they didn't want to be different. One of the worst things said about anyone in the Bible was about those rulers who actually believed in Christ but would not confess it lest they be cast out of the synagogue, for they loved the praise of men more than the praise of God. This is how the world makes us conform. We don't want to be cast out of the synagogue. And there are synagogues all around us that are ready to do us in if we don't fit the mold. It starts in grade school and never lets up all the way to the factory and the office and the church. Always the demand to conform. Always the demonic whisper, one must get along, one must not rock the boat. Do you think anyone has ever blessed us greatly in human history who bought completely into that creed? I can't think of a single name. There really is a system at work always in economics and religion and politics, and it does not tolerate nonconformity that really does threaten it. Martin Luther was no problem for the established church, so long as the Pope could brush off his antics as merely, quote, a monk's quarrel. It was when he became a real threat that the Pope felt, for the system's sake, he had to bring the monk to trial. I have no idea whether the motives of that former tobacco company executive are good or bad when he swears his bosses deliberately manipulated the nicotine levels in cigarettes so as to hook people on the drug and guarantee high profits. But their retaliation makes me think he must be telling the truth. Whether he's telling it now for conscience' sake or for revenge, he has refused to conform to the rules prescribed for him, and the result could ultimately become one of the greatest blessings ever conferred upon the American public. Paul would argue that the noblest kind of nonconformity comes when our minds are renewed by dwelling on what is honest and decent and good. We hear more about renewing the body than the mind. Glamour studios that promise a new look, ever more popular cosmetic surgery with its reward of new eyelids, new nose, new lips, new neck, and all those other anatomical rearrangements you were wondering if I would name. I don't blame people for improving on nature or reversing the ravages of gravity, but my principal business is with the mind. The religious life, after all, does not work like an automatic thermostat. You have to keep resetting it, keep renewing it. Otherwise, after a while, all that is left is what some thoughtful person called in what I think is a marvelous phrase, the ghost of an old amazement. Have you ever visited a church where no one seems very happy? No one sings with delight? No one listens to the sermon, having heard it 100 times already? Nothing left in the place but the ghost of an old amazement. A popular, if sometimes risque, modern slogan can be applied to meditation, to prayer, to worship, to reading skills. Use it or lose it. Actors in Broadway plays that run for years explain how they keep their performance fresh. We have to recover, they say, the illusion of the first time. Renewal. Our old Puritan congregational ancestors loved the idea so much that if you look carefully at some old New England church lists and cemeteries, you find names like Renewed Robinson, Renewed Cartwright. Not a one-time-only process, either. As they well knew, I find it fascinating to hear from dear friends I knew when we were young and heedless and immortal and immensely full of ourselves, and to discover that they have discovered renewal. They take more seriously now what I would call spiritual matters, except that the word has been used so tackily it often embarrasses me. One of the brightest women I know wrote a few days ago from Los Angeles about the things that renew her mind. She wonders in her letter if they can be called spiritual, since they are not conventional things. She speaks of Pavarotti and great theater and the possible loss of irreplaceable friends. But she has been in church, too, and found renewal there. She says of a friend here, whom she has known since they were in college together, and I'm quoting her letter, "Billy singing spirituals in the choir is, of course, a spiritual experience. So maybe all is not lost for me. I cried buckets that day I visited your church and would have shouted, danced, and gesticulated had it been seemly." She knows, of course, that feelings, however genuine, are not enough. That renewal may take one, as it has taken her, to the AIDS patient and the illiterate. That in Christian thought, the reason for renewal is that we may prove in practice that the plan of God for us is good. We can argue doctrine and theology for eternity and prove nothing much at all for those not already on our side, but the world cannot successfully argue against a renewed mind and a changed life. All of you see the Salvation Army bell ringers around Christmas, but some of you can remember when those little Salvation Army bands used to play and give their testimonies on a street corner. Do I see an affirmative nod? Yes, here and there. The gray-haired one. Who with me used to hear those bands? Well, here is a moment from those days when the man playing the bass drum was asked to speak. There was a little murmur in the crowd that day because he looked, to put it as kindly as possible, a bit unpredictable. You could tell he wasn't used to speaking to an audience, and you guessed that his testimony was likely to be short. It was. Well, he said, before I was converted, I led a wild life. I drank all the time. I caroused on the weekends. I gambled away every paycheck. But since I've been converted, he paused and smiled, all I do is beat this damn drum. Everybody laughed for a few seconds, and then everybody stopped because they suddenly realized from the look in his eyes that he was not unhappy after all, that behind the words was a note of new self-respect, a kind of grudging affection for an old drum that had become the symbol of his changed life. In silence for a moment, he and the crowd looked at one another, and every last one of them understood perfectly what he had tried in his native tongue to tell them. They were as reflective when they walked away as any crowd I have ever seen leaving church after a sermon. One last time, don't let the world around you squeeze you into its own mold. But let God remold your minds from within so that you may prove in practice that His plan for you is good. If you forget the rest when you leave this morning, remember three words: prove in practice. Emotion evaporates uselessly unless life changes in some practical way, no matter how simple. Like the hotel cleaning lady years ago in my hometown who had been converted during what used to be called a gospel meeting. I won't ask you to identify yourselves again. And was asked later, what difference Jesus made in her life? Her answer was, I don't sweep dirt under the carpets anymore. And you?